You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 25th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, discussing the question as to whether Donald Trump is a populist, Jeet Heer, contributing editor to the New Republic. Also on the program today, three out of the remaining 116 Guantanamo prisoners were actually captured by the United States. The remaining 113... we took somebody's word for it. Also on the program today is Ted Cruz consolidating the religious right. Jeb Bush exclaims, hey, when I say anchor babies, I'm talking about Asians. Oh, my God. Duh. Is this the guy that the worst candidate ever or the really worst candidate ever? Meanwhile, a major tax preparer has made taxes significantly more difficult to fill out for low-income people. That's the way they do, ladies and gentlemen. All that and more on today's program. Just catching up, feeling a little bit under the weather today, folks. So please forgive me. We're going to try and keep it under wraps. The stock market, I don't know. With all due respect, I mean, if you are close to retirement, I would imagine perhaps there's some concern, but it doesn't seem terribly big. And we know that this is not really an indicator in any way about the economy, and it really doesn't impact the economy unless you get like a 40% loss of wealth. But I feel like I should mention it just because in some quarters it seems like the greatest. It's interesting. I mean, if you talk to different people out and about, I wasn't even aware of it until, I don't know. Yeah, I was just not, I just don't pay attention to it. To the extent that I have any money in the stock market, it is all in a pension account that I can't touch for less than 20 years.
Gold, dude?
And of course, no. And then, of course, immediately what I do is I go out and I buy massive amounts of gold because everybody knows when the stock market drops 40%, then everybody accepts gold.
That's how it is.
I go into the Walgreens to pick up a tube of toothpaste. Here's my gold nugget. I'd like the change in gold, too, please. The good thing is that the pharmacy around the corner from us, they now accept tulips. So, yeah, so that was good. And they'll give you your change will come in the form of petals or part of a stem. North Korea and South Korea apparently are no longer in a state of quasi-war. That's good. And Donald Trump has been tweeting at Megyn Kelly. Let me just preface everything. We'll have I'm going to get to. I'm going to get to Ajit in just a second, but I should just say, right now, according to I think it's Politico, the Virginia and North Carolina Republican parties are in discussions about implementing a new requirement for candidates to qualify for their primary ballots that they pledge to support the Republican presidential nominee and not run as third-party candidates in the general election. That is what you would probably call the Trump clause. Just to give you an indication of how nervous they are about Trump at this point in the Republican Party, he is now polling at 35% in New Hampshire. With number two comes in, it's Kasich in for the PPP poll that came out this morning. I just had it, and I don't know where it went now. But Kasich is number two at 11%, and then the rest of them. So Trump is going to be here for a while. We're going to talk a little bit later. I have some theories as to maybe I'll ask Jeet as to what his theory is to Trump's exit strategy, because I'm not convinced the guy who necessarily wants to be president. Lifestyle-wise, it seems like a little bit more work than he probably is interested in doing at this age. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jeet here. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Jeet here. He is the senior editor at, or a senior editor, I should say, at the New Republic. On his piece, Donald Trump is not a populist. He's the voice of aggrieved privilege. Welcome back to the program, Jeet.
Good to be back.
So, all right, let's I've been fascinated about the sort of the different characterizations of Trump and his appeal to the Republican Party that kicked in, I guess, a couple of weeks after his announcement, when people started to realize that he may very well have some traction. The latest is that it's his populist rhetoric. We even see him sometimes sort of analogized to Bernie Sanders. Of course, I think, you know, people tend to be talking about two different types of populism. But you argue that he's not really a populist, as much as I think some Republicans are hoping to argue.
Yeah, no, I think the populist label is misapplied to Trump, because I'm actually basing this on sort of some research that was published in the New York Times, where they did a sort of breakdown of who supports Trump, and it's really the Republican base, right? Like, it's like he's a Republican candidate and he's doing better than everyone else because he's popular among Republicans. He's not very popular among anyone who's not a Republican. Like, he's pretty widely loathed by independents and Democrats. But if you ask Republicans, you'll find that they support him, and that includes people who call themselves moderate Republicans, and also college-educated Republicans. Now, in the world I live in, college-educated Republicans are not populist. Like if you're a college-educated Republican, it's highly likely that you're making, you know, much more than the average income. So I just don't see that as a proper label. I think he is the unvarnished face of the Republican Party.
Yes, and that that last part in particular, I agree with. And let's talk about the support, because I think so much of the talk around Donald Trump is focused on Trump. And in some respects, I feel that this story at the end of the day is less about Trump, but more about what has been created over the course of 25, 30 years. And I think, you know, some would argue has always been there, but I would argue has sort of moved from the broad margins, closer to the center of, you know, it's no longer the wings of the party as much as it is the fuselage, it seems to me.
I think that's exactly right. Like, I think, Trump didn't come out of nowhere, right? In some ways it's similar to all these, closeted, conservatives who.
Oh, are you there? Okay, folks, give us, 1 second. We're going to ring him back. We'll be right back. Sorry, G. We lost you there. You were talking about these closeted conservatives.
Yeah, well, I mean, just like it's like in some ways, I mean, the way to look at Trump is that he's an uncloseted conservative, right? Like the closeted, you know, you find these closeted conservatives who suddenly, you know, turn out to be hiring male prostitutes or found in the men's having sex in the men's room in a washroom, and it's like. It's so shocking. How did this happen? Well, it's not shocking. It's like who they are, and it's not become public. The same with Trump. It's like, why is it so shocking that someone who made bigoted remarks about an ethnic group is suddenly the leading candidate of the Republican Party? It's not shocking. It's just something that's coming out of the closet.
Yes, I mean, I think in some respects, Trump is delivering the subtext, and the others are just delivering the text. But let's talk about this notion of, you also make the argument in your piece that the definition of what is populist has been. Is largely incorrect, or has been in some ways, I guess, distorted over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it's an argument that, you know, sort of historians have. But if you go back to like the origins of the term populist, it's the sort of, you know, People's Party of the 1880s and 1890s, and they were like, you know, sort of farmers from the West who were like upset about things that many of us today are upset about. They thought America was becoming too corporate, that the robber barons had taken over, that democracy was in danger, and their solution was to have government solutions, to have government nationalize the railways, to take over public utilities, to try to expand democracy by having direct elections of senators and by giving women the vote, right? So by the 1950s, there was a change in the way people saw populism, because historians like Richard Hofstadter, most influentially, started to say, link populism with right-wing movements, and to say Joseph McCarthy is the heir of the populist. And I think that's kind of mistaken. I mean, I do think there is a type of right-wing populism, But if you look at someone like Joseph McCarthy or the John Birch Society or the Tea Party, none of them are really populist. I think they're more accurately described as rich people's movement. And they use populist rhetoric, but they're usually financed and controlled by wealthy Republicans and are usually designed to preserve privilege. I mean, McCarthy was financed by, you know, Midwestern business elites as a way to fight the New Deal and to fight labor unions. The Tea Party is similar. Like, if you actually look at the demographics of the Tea Party, it's people who are actually wealthier than the average and have better education than the average. So I think it's like, it's not a grassroots movement. These are kind of like elite movements. And they're especially movements to preserve privilege. They're movements of aggrieved privilege. So I think that's worth bearing in mind.
And Hofstadter, it seems to me, had talked about this concept of status anxiety, which it seems to me is not terribly different from aggrieved privilege, right? I mean, that just seems to me to be inherent. Status anxiety seems to be sort of almost baked into the cake of the conservative brain, because there's a certain amount of authoritarianism, and then there's a certain amount of sense of, like, everything that's out there that you are not intimately aware of understanding of is out to get you or ruin your world in some way.
Yeah, no, I think there's something to that. Although I don't quite, for a variety of reasons, I think I'm not happy with status anxiety, because I think what is really at the root of this is like power. It's like a fear of losing power. And these are movements that are, you know, they're the movement of the haves, and they have this sort of, like, you know, fear of social revolution. So you look at something like the John Birch Society or the Tea Party, they were both given a lot of money by the Koch family, right? So I think that the status anxiety analysis sort of makes sense, but I really want to highlight the fact that what's really driving this is a fear of social change and a fear that, like, the wrong people are, you know, gaining in society, whether it's, like, immigrants from south of the border or women, right? And I think if you look at Trump, like, it really seems that his base is energized by his war on so-called political correctness. Like, if you hang around Trump followers or look at what they're posting online, they really love the fact that he's not politically correct, so-called. And then basically what that means is he's willing to stand up to non-whites and to women. And so I think that's what's driving us.
And also, you know, those sort of, I guess, those race and gender traitors who ally themselves with non-whites and women, who talk all namby-pamby, and Trump is not willing to do so. I mean, I think that's the, you know, because at the end of the day, I mean, Trump is starting to offer policy solutions on some to some extent that are really in some ways aligned with Bernie Sanders, right? I mean, he's been very vocal, or at least in the past, and I think he's at least touched on it, on protecting Social Security and Medicare. He basically this weekend made a strong argument for progressive taxation and against a flat tax. This is all stuff but that to me seems coincidental to really that fundamental part about him not being PC, that this is so much about dispositionally in some respects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, it would be interesting to know if the sort of economic stances he's taken, like, help him, or in some ways maybe they open up a vulnerability within the Republican Party, because I do think that, like, just based on, you know, the enthusiasm that he got for the Mexican comments and for taking on Megyn Kelly, like, it does seem a lot of this is based on, being Mr. I'm not PC, and I'm willing to tell it like it is and stand up to people. I mean, there is a sense in which the economic side of Republicanism has always been less popular than the social stuff, right?
Right.
That the, you know, in some ways the social anxieties are used to sell a really unpopular economic agenda, because unless you're like, you know, on the 1%, these policies don't really help you. So I think in some ways Trump is, I mean, what might be terrifying is that there might be a shrewd move on his part to, like, you know, move away from the unpopular economic policies, and to give people what they want, which is, like, you know, Social Security, Medicare, progressive taxation, and combine it with all these racial and gender anxieties.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that he knows that he could take these positions that are economically sort of at odds with the typical Republican fare, and it's not going to cost him any votes with his base, which is apparently, like, you know, 15-20% of the Republican Party. It's not going to cost him any votes, because at the end of the day, they don't care. They just want some measure of respect or look to him because he's so powerful. Powerful projecting, and then he's just sort of picking up some other sort of stray votes by actually offering some policies that resonate with people. I mean, Social Security has broad popularity even amongst the Republican base. Mm-hmm. Here's one point that interests me that nobody seems to be touching on. You have a conservative mindset that is so authoritarian in its it's just sort of worldview. I mean, that's what really just sort of like hits all the synapses for them. It seems to me that the Republican Party has overlaid on that conservative predisposition the idea of money and poor shaming, and its, I guess, corollary that, well, you are sort of morally righteous if you're rich, and this guy's a billionaire.
Yeah.
And so he...
That's right. Yeah, Trump is the ideal that they've created, right? Like, and if you remember, I don't know if you're as old as I am, but I remember when Trump first emerged in the 80s as a public figure, and that was really part of Reaganism, right?
Yeah.
Like, Trump was exactly the sort of, you know, greedy SOB that you would see, you know, coming out of, you know, the 1980s of, you know, like, greed is good. That decade. I mean, he became a big public figure because he doesn't hide his greed. He's very ostentatious. He is a real child of that era. I just think the Republican Party is getting what they deserve. And the only problem is, it's also going to affect other people outside the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, I would argue to the better. I mean, you know, Josh Marshall wrote a piece that was, I think, in some ways inspired by the piece that you wrote. And he called Trump, he said, one of the great injuries Trump has already done to America and our collective dignity is we're now forced to take him seriously in terms of understanding what he represents in political terms. To me, that's one of the, on the contrary, it's not a great injury, it's a great service, because it seems to me that at one point in this campaign, we're going to get to the point where all the stuff that the establishment and the sort of the mainstream conventional wisdom will get past the idea of, like, he's got better name recognition, he's simply a showman, and they'll ultimately have to land on this notion that the Republican Party has been building shadow Trump for years, right? And it just
moment where Dr. Frankenstein realizes that the monster has a will of its own and can't be controlled, right? That's the moment of where we're at. I think in that sense, it's good. I mean, I just worry about the repercussions, because I think one of the things, I mean, there's always been a lot of racism, but Trump is really normalizing racism in a way that we haven't seen since George Wallace in the 60s, right? Like, I'm just basing on stuff I see online. Like, there's a type of language that you used to see only on Stormfront or on these, like, you know, neo-Nazi websites, which is, like, becoming more aggressively vocal. And because I write about Trump, I get that stuff all the time. And so I really feel that a lot of these, you know, hardcore white supremacist types who might have gotten along with the Republican Party because of the dog whistles, but now they're like really super enthusiastic because of Trump, and they think like he's their man. This is their moment. And that's kind of scary.
We can see this even in the context of Jeb Bush, right? I mean, his language has changed, too. This guy wrote a memo about not using anchor babies, and now the best he can do is, well, I only meant it about Asians.
That's right, yeah. No, I mean, it's a huge problem for Jeb Bush. I mean, it's almost as if Trump were created in a laboratory to, like, open up all the fissures that, like, the Republican elite would normally want to keep closed, right? Like he so perfectly hits on all the issues that kind of like are internally problematic for the party. The sort of division between the business elite that wants immigration reform and the base that doesn't, you know, or the business elite that wants, you know, to gut Social Security and the base that doesn't. Like Trump really is opening up all the wounds. Yeah, and in that sense, it's delightful.
And do you, I mean, you know, I have been trying to, I mean, I don't think that there is really a line of attack that takes any votes away from Trump at this point. I mean, I really don't. It's conceivable to me that maybe he doesn't have the ground game or maybe and his actual desire to become president is another issue I want to touch on in a minute. But I mean, I don't see how, unless he loses $4 billion tomorrow, because I really do think when he sits on that stage with the other Republicans, they can criticize him all he wants. The people watching that debate have been trained for years that if you are a billionaire, you necessarily are just better, period, than everyone around you. You have the better answers. You lead the better life. You are more morally righteous. God is shining down upon you in a better way. All of it. And it doesn't matter what they say to him. At the end of the day, this is the billionaire. And we've been told that money is the measure of virtue in our society.
Yeah, no, it's hard to really see anything that they can get on Trump where but also because he can override their message. Like, I think if you go back to 2012, like when Gingrich was riding high, Romney was able to kind of like, you know, destroy him with all these attack ads in Florida, and Gingrich just didn't have the money to respond. I mean, the thing with Trump is, like, you know, just because of who he is, he gets all the free media, and he has, you know, he's kind of a genius at social media as well, with like Twitter and whatnot. And so he can like talk over their heads. There's nothing. And then really, what opposition research can you do against Trump? Like, what can you say about this guy that isn't like already amply on the public record, right?
Like, everything's going to, I mean, all this stuff, I think, will stick to him in the general. But in the president, in the Republican Party, I mean, all of what we perceive as liabilities, I think, simply go to his strengths. And so here's my other question. What's his exit strategy? Because, I mean, I'm fairly convinced that a guy like this does not want to be president because of the amount of work involved. And why would he want to? I mean, he wants to appoint the president. I have a theory about what the exit strategy is going to be. I think he's going to claim that someone in his family is ill and he has to drop out, both as a to show that he's selfless in terms of his family and in terms of the country. What's your notion, or is it just not even worth a guess?
I don't know. I mean, like, it's hard to know with a figure like Trump. I mean, I do actually kind of agree. It's hard to imagine him going all the way with this. And there's a lot of it. I mean, like, he really hasn't been building up the ground game. Like, there's sort of he's been hiring a few people, but it would be hard for him to actually do that. I do think, like, one solution is just at a certain point, find a pretext to get out and then throw your support around, like, Ted Cruz, right? Like,
right.
I think that would be, and then be the kingmaker. I mean, I think your instincts are right, that the goal is to be the kingmaker, not to be the king, right? Like,
he tells us all the time, like, I'm a businessman. I want them to come to my wedding and this and that. He, yeah. It just seems that he would love to say, like, I've decided that John Kasich is going to be the guy. And,
I do think there's a personal element with Trump in this, in the sense that he does not want Jeb Bush to be president. Like, he's kind of, there's a really great article by Gabriel Snyder in New York Magazine, which basically, you know, quoted Trump talking to a friend, where he basically said, you know, like, if I'm going down, Jeb is going to go down with me. He's not going to be president. And, cause I mean, like, Trump kind of blames Jeb Bush for, like, a lot of the financial stuff of losing deals with Univision. So there's a personal element to that. Like,
And give me your sense of, I mean, just looking at those people who write about this stuff. I mean, is this, you know, I'm starting to see pieces, will Trump rebrand the GOP as a white nationalist party, et cetera. I mean, do you see any change in the way that people are perceiving Trump's followers? I mean, because this is the Republican base, right? I mean, this is the same people who ostensibly railed against the Affordable Care Act, right? Who now support a candidate who's for a single payer. I mean, that is about as much of a reversal as you could get. I mean, it goes beyond reversing, right? And or they hate taxation, and here's a guy who's coming out for progressive taxation. They like less government, but here's a guy who supports Social Security. I mean, is it wiping the veneer off this? I mean, at least in the eyes of those who report on this stuff. I mean, do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think people's, at least in a lot of the mainstream media, their ability to be delusional is pretty strong. And I think a lot of this sort of reference to Trump as a populist is a way of, like, you know, trying to create a euphemism for the reality, which is, like, he's a bigot. Mm-hmm. and then it's the bigotry that's driving everything. So I don't know. I mean, like, I think eventually it'll have to come out. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is he's, like, leading among evangelical voters, and, like, it's hard to imagine a politician in American public life that's, like, you know, more antithetical to, like, religion than Trump is, right?
Right.
Like, he just, like, you know, the many marriages, the sort of lecherous behavior, the decadence, the celebration of wealth, you know, the contempt for people, the contempt for the poor. Like, it's like, but, you know, evangelical Christians love them. So what can we do?
I mean, I think it gets back to that notion of they've been sold this idea that, you know, the opposite of poor shaming is rich praising, I guess. And this is you know, if he's this rich, God must be on his side, it seems to me. I think that's coming home to roost a little bit. Let me ask you one more thing about the populist thing. Do you think, and I understand that you look at the paranoid style as perhaps the beginning of this meme of sort of revising what populism was about in the turn of the 19th and, or I should say the 20th century, or between the 1800s and 1900s. Do you think that this is sort of, there is an ease in which this sense is maintained as a way of throwing the baby out with the bathwater? In other words, one of the ways that those with power will fight off any type of populist sentiment is to lump it in with a sort of virulent nationalism or anti-Semitism or racism.
Yeah, I think there's that sort of hostility towards popular movements. And we kind of saw that with the way people are trying to say, well, Bernie Sanders is just like Trump, right? But, you know, like, I mean, there's a huge difference. I mean, if there is some overlap in terms of, like, some of the economic stuff, there's a huge difference in terms of the racism, right? And so, I mean, I think a lot of this sort of trying to code this stuff as pure populism is a way of, like, resisting social movements. And it really came out of this sort of Cold War sensibility where, like, you know, middle-of-the-road mainstream America was good, right? Like, you know, I like Ike, So you want like sort of, you know, moderate Republicans or moderate Democrats, and anyone who's like on the extreme left or the extreme right is poison. And I sort of want to resist the temptation to like lump, you know, anybody who's critical of the social order as being the same as Trump, right? Like, he is playing to a lot of populist anger, but there's like, you know, there's ways of being populist without being like an anti-Semite or a racist.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it'll be interesting to see if Bernie Sanders actually takes the time to make a baseball cap that says "Make America Great Again," because that'll be.
I think the more serious side of this is I think a lot of right-wing populist sentiment comes from people who become dissatisfied with the mainstream because it doesn't give them what they want, right? Like, a lot of people turn to the extreme right because they feel like, you know, they're losing their job, they're losing their ways of life, and sort of people like Trump can sort of fill that void. So in some ways, you know, maybe the Trump-Sanders thing makes sense in the sense that unless you have like a strong left-wing movement like Bernie Sanders, you're going to get Trump.
I'm not convinced of that. I mean, because, and maybe it's just because I've spent the better part of the last 10 years professionally and frankly years before that, just from a performing standpoint, listening to guys like Rush Limbaugh and Donald Trump. I mean, the issues are secondary. It is really this thing of like, do not doubt yourself. That money is a sign of the wealth accumulation is a sign that you're doing things right. If you haven't, there is something fundamentally at the core of you wrong. And of course, that judgment only applies to other people who are poor, right? Like, it's you have been screwed over by the black guy who cut ahead of you in line because of the government if you haven't gotten yours. And all of this seems to be just a function of that. It might be like rechanneling of some type of, you know, like slow, loss of wages and status in society. But at the end of the day, this is all Rush Limbaugh, it seems to me.
I think that's right. That does seem to be the core issue. And it's interesting that, like, in terms of Trump's ability to flourish despite the GOP going after him, I mean, he has a whole media network of his own, right? He has Ann Coulter, he has Rush Limbaugh, he has like a whole world outside of Fox News. And
Has insurgent Fox News, right? I mean, he won that battle with Megyn Kelly because he had Hannity and Fox and Friends, and he's more Fox than she is.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's exactly, and he speaks to the Fox core audience in a way that she doesn't. So it comes back to the fact that there's a kind of salutary ripping off of the mask, right?
Yes.
Like, yeah.
And I got to say, I'm enjoying it. Ajit here, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been great to be on.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. We have some fun sound for you. As Michael heads to get me the sound sheet. It still becomes, you know, increasingly fascinating to me. I mean, you know what else is also sort of interesting? And I wonder if what will happen if we do see one of these trade deals come up during the Fast Track Authority? Because we hear Trump talk about China, China, China. Have we seen anything online yet that suggests that the reason why the Chinese economy is tanking is because they're so afraid of Trump? I mean, is it just a matter of time that is going to happen? But this stuff is going to have, I think, you know, and I've been saying this all along, and I still continue to believe it, which is why I'm following this stuff with, this is guilt-free for me. It's rare that I enjoy myself this much without some semblance of guilt. Well, it's rare that I enjoy myself. Let's be honest with that. But this is guilt-free stuff because I really do think that this is going to have important policy implications, and we're going to start to see it. when they get back from holiday, when they get back from the Senate recess in particular, we're going to start to see this stuff play out. And I don't think we're going to actually get any real policy, but we're going to start to see stuff that is going to implicate policy in a year or two down the road. In the fun half today, we will we do have some other stories to touch on, but we also will play that Jeb Bush at a press conference in McAllen, Texas. I mean, the guy is just it's really impressive. That this guy is.
He's so lackluster that he makes you talk like Donald Trump to describe him, even when you're not trying to.
I mean, at this point, like, who is, you know, I think, like I say, I've always said that Kasich is a bit of a sleeper, but I am just amazed that Jeb Bush, he's got a lot of money. It'll be interesting to see how much he has on hand. It'll be interesting to see, like, what his fundraising has been now. Because if I'm one of those people, unless I really enjoy good money after bad, I'm done giving to Jeb Bush unless I see something happening. And frankly, Scott Walker. But we'll see. All right, let's take a quick break. Folks, reminder, this program exists only because of our members. Our members make it possible for us to do a free show every day. Most days. I mean, like 90%. 95% of, almost like 99% of Monday through Friday, we do a show. And, of course, as a way of saying thank you, we also give you an extra 40, 50 hour of bonus material every day as well. You can become a member. Just head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. They have free shipping. It's great coffee. And everybody gets a fair wage throughout the entire process. Check it out. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it from our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com and at majority.fm/review. You can give us a review on iTunes, which helps people know that we're here and spread the word. As we head into this very tumultuous election season, will Joe Biden run? Probably not. That would be my guess. You say probably?
Why not?
Well, let's have a debate. And then my Twitter followers will attack you and your Twitter followers will attack me.
You completely don't understand Joe Biden's running for president. Totally unfair.
I will be talking about it. I had a little Twitter exchange with Sam Harris, and I will address that in the fun half. And sometime, I think this week, maybe, we'll have Kyle Kalinske on, who, according to the Twitter, destroyed you in that in your appearance on it.
There have been all sorts. Actually, you know what was great? Was one person wrote, it was good. Both good points. Michael won. And then they followed up with, oh, excuse me, in Twitter language, Brooks destroys Kalinske. Hey. It's funny.
But we'll have Kyle on. I mean, I'm not terribly excited about it, but we'll do it. All right, we'll take a quick break. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You have the IM information. You can IM me via the app. We'll be right back. You can pick it up at majorityapp.com.